Tonight, the Bucks are off, and the Bulls will host the Miami Heat. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for Wednesday, April 9th. Cloudy and cold, maybe some rain showers later this morning, possibly snow showers for the afternoon, maybe 1 inch of accumulation, and today's high 43. Right now, wind south at 10. It is 40 in Racine, 39 in Kenosha, 36 to the west for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is very exciting and fun to be reconnecting with a very good friend to WGTD and the Morning Show, Amy Grile, Executive Director of the Kenosha Community Foundation. And she has joined us on a number of occasions to talk about the good work of the Kenosha Community Foundation, who they are, what they are, the difference that they seek to make in the community. And we're going to be talking with another very special guest today, John Keel, who has been instrumental in helping to implement a very, very exciting new gift, if you will, for the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra on behalf of his beloved aunt. And we will be talking about all of that and more over the next few minutes. And Amy Grile and John Keel, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Thanks, thank Greg.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
So happy to have both of you here. Amy, before we get into the specifics of this new undertaking or endeavor that I know you are excited to talk about, I think it would be valuable to begin with the basics and remind everybody about what the Kenosha Community Foundation is and maybe what is most important for the general public to know about how it functions and what its purpose is.
Sure. So we are a nonprofit community foundation. So this is a sort of people's foundation, if you will, that we really make it an easy entry into philanthropy for ideally those that are locally based that want to keep their money right here locally in the Kenosha area. So essentially how it works, we take private wealth and we invest it and we create public good. So through an investment model, we obviously are very invested in the sense of endowing gifts so that they can be here for the long haul, in perpetuity, returning value back to the community. So as we'll hear today from John, it's a wonderful vehicle for those that want to ensure their gifts are here for the long haul and can really leave a legacy for an individual long after they may pass and, you know, really create an impact here that is sustaining in the long haul anyway.
As we were speaking before we went on the air, you utilized the term conduit at one point. And maybe you could remind our listeners, first of all, what that word means in general and then how you are utilizing it to describe the work and the mission of the Kenosha Community Foundation.
Great. Yeah, this is a new word for me that I'm just like really loving to bring back into, I guess, fashion. But as a donor comes to me and talk about, you know, to talk about their passions and what they'd like to do with their wealth, we look at the Kenosha Community Foundation as sort of like the pit stop, the conduit to giving to the local community. So in the case that we'll hear about today, the passion was for symphonic music. The Kenosha Symphony Orchestra was that organization. But rather than going direct to the symphony, it made a lot of sense to use this sort of pit stop of the Kenosha Community Foundation so that the gift could reside with us through the endowment, and then we would be giving grants in perpetuity back to the symphony. So that's where we want to be. As a nonprofit, we are not situated in the sense of like competing with other nonprofits. You know, of course, we regret that nonprofits have to compete with one another at all. But in any case, we're not competing in that sense. We're actually serving the interests of the nonprofit all the more. If we had a competitor, it would probably be Fidelity or something. Our model is very different in that donors can come to us with a smaller gift. Certainly, our minimums are around $10,000 just to get started. And we serve as a conduit to get those resources and the interest earned off the investment to ultimately support nonprofits throughout the community.
Before we went on the air, you made specific mention of the fact that the Kenosha Community Foundation takes great pride in the difference that you have made in the realm of the arts. And I think that it's important for us to say that you do good work on behalf of all kinds of worthy causes in the community, but that certainly the arts and the performing arts especially have certainly figured prominently in what you have done and the difference that various people have been able to make in the community.
Absolutely. We can go into a lot of those spaces that say a United Way that has a sort of three pillars for basic needs and education. We can really go in, you know, really any direction with such a flexible model, and there's really no limits as far as I'm concerned to meeting the charitable intent of a given donor.
Wonderful. We have with us in the morning show today for part one, Amy Grile, who is executive director of the Kenosha Community Foundation. And we have with us as well in the studios, John Keel. Amy, I want to give you an opportunity to describe your initial encounter with John Keel and say a little bit about why he joins us today.
Well, sure. So when I began at the Kenosha Community Foundation relatively recently, this was the end of 2022, so I'm just a pup in the field, so to speak, of in philanthropy. But certainly the name Grace Kolakowski was a prominent sort of, I don't know, just this kind of mythical name, if you will, because I had read so much about her as of late, whether it was her gift to Carthage or her initial seeding of a gift for the Performing Arts Center. So I was aware of Grace Kolakowski. I then was... It was a fortuitous, I guess, opportunity when I had some outreach from John to say maybe we could, you know, bring Grace in and kind of talk a little more about how she's engaged with the Kenosha Community Foundation historically. So, you know, with great sweaty palms and, like, you know, sort of like this, oh my, like I get to meet this, I mean, what I have come to know, certainly just a phenomenal person, a legacy of her own and just wealth of gifts. Got to meet Grace and then at the same time her great nephew, John Keel. Mm. So we've become friends and colleagues and all the things, and I'm just really pleased he could be here today.
As am I. John Keel, we again welcome you to the morning show. We're so happy that you are here and that we can talk about the extraordinary legacy of Grace Kolakowski. First of all, I think it would be helpful for anybody who happens to listen who does not necessarily know the story of your great aunt and who she is, who she was, where she came from, and kind of in general her considerable legacy, particularly for the sake of, for instance, Walworth County listeners and others in, you know, more far afield, might not know this story the way so many of us in the community do.
It's a fascinating story and one that I'm really happy to share with you. So she's my great aunt, my mother's aunt. She was born and raised in Rudolph, Wisconsin, on a dairy farm, the youngest of eight children. And when she was 16 years old, decided she did not want to be a farmer's wife. And so her plan was to take the train from central Wisconsin to Milwaukee to become an artist at the Layton School of Art in Milwaukee. So she, that art has been in her life forever. Well, on that fateful trip from central Wisconsin to Milwaukee, she happened to encounter a friend of hers who was traveling with two nuns. Because she was interested in becoming a nun in Milwaukee. Well, so during the course of that trip, train trip from central Wisconsin to Milwaukee, Grace decided to join the convent at age 16.
Slight detour.
And the really ironic thing is that her friend only stayed in the convent 6 weeks, and Grace stayed 21 years. So, yeah, so she was a Franciscan nun from age 16 until age 37, left in the mid-60s, and with $500 in her pocket as she left the convent and started a teaching career, first in parochial schools in the Milwaukee area and then public schools, and then eventually becoming a principal. So her whole career was spent in education. And the arts were always in the background. Well, then she moved to Kenosha. She married twice. Her first husband passed away after a very short time. And then she met Lenny Kolakowski, and they got married. And so she lived in Kenosha, and then she commuted to Milwaukee while she was still working there. Well, during the course of being involved in Kenosha, she got to know Mayor Antaramian. And her passion has been for the performing arts. And so she and a group of, I think about 12 women, formed a group that were championing this idea of a performing arts center for the city of Kenosha, or the region here. Well, and putting her money where her mouth was, she seeded that endeavor with $100,000, like to do a feasibility study. Will this thing work? And so they hired architects and they hired researchers to say, well, is this a viable option? And it was. So unfortunately, though, through other priorities in the city, it never reached the level where it was a viable project. And so actually in 23, so I moved down here to become to Grace's caregiver in July of 23. She's going to be 96. Mr. Antaramian came to the house and said, in short words, unfortunately, Grace, this is a great idea. I still love it. I'm a backer of this idea. But unfortunately, there are other priorities that the city has. And so this is just not going to happen. So we looked at each other. He said, now what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And so her idea was, well, I gave the money to the foundation. It had been, I think, 7 years they had had the money under their management. And she said, I want my money back. if they're not going to build this, give me my money back. So then we began the process of exploring how that might be done. Well, then that's how we got in contact with Amy, because she would be the one who would be involved with that process of getting the money back to Grace. Well, then she set up the meeting. She said, I'm really curious to meet your aunt. I would like to explore her passions and her whole motivation for being a philanthropist. So I think the first meeting was an hour or 2 hours in Amy's office. She was very generous with her time and really explored Grace's life and, why do you want to do this with your money? So to make a long story short, the money that had been designated for the Performing Arts Center has now become the funds that finances three scholarships at Mary Bradford High School. Mm-hmm. So Grace, has a heart. She was a teacher. She was a principal, and so her whole idea is let's support local youth to go to local universities so that they stay local. Mm-hmm. So the scholarships are only for Gateway, Carthage, or Parkside. It has to go to Mary Bradford students, and then they have to study and get their degrees here. Right. So it's brilliant.
Wow.
She's a very, very smart philanthropist.
In addition to being generous.
In addition to being generous, yes.
Amy, do I remember correctly that you grew up in rural Wisconsin? And did you grow up on a farm?
Indeed. I grew up on a dairy farm not so far away in Waterford, Wisconsin. But yes, proud daughter of dairy farmers. My father and my mom are still on the farm. And yeah, once you're a dairy farmer, you're always a dairy farmer.
So you and Grace Kolakowski had that in common. And I have a feeling one reason that meeting went 2 hours is you probably had – had dairy farming lore to share with one another.
Absolutely. And also, I just have to say, my mother's mother, June Schultz was her name. Like, she has a similar kind of story. She came down from the Upper Peninsula on a train to Milwaukee and, like, actually lived in Milwaukee for years. But it was like, I was actually felt like I was speaking to my grandma June, like as I'm talking with Grace, because there was just something about her eyes, and I don't know. It's pretty powerful when you get into it.
It is. Yeah. It honestly is
wonderful. John Keel, tell us what you know, and I assume it's a fair amount, about your great aunt's love of the arts, and where did that come from? And as far as you know, was that a part of her life and an important interest for her even way back when? I mean, even back on the farm? Or is that something that, as she moved into, for instance, the Milwaukee area, that started to become such a passion for her?
I think it's the latter. Her interest personally is in the graphic arts. She's a watercolorist, and her home is filled with small watercolors. So she's not a singer. She's not an instrumentalist. But I think coming to this area and seeing a great need, you know, Chicago has performing arts, Milwaukee has performing arts, what does Kenosha have? And for a city of 100,000 people, she said, we deserve our own performing arts center. And so that was her passion in supporting that project.
Very good. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about the experience of playing this important role in her life. And maybe even ahead of that, tell us a little bit about your own personal relationship with your great aunt over the years, even ahead of 2023 when you came to play this new role in her life.
Well, great aunt Grace was always kind of the star of the family. I mean, she either didn't work in the paper mills in central Wisconsin. She wasn't on a farm. She'd come to Milwaukee, and she was the nun, and then she was the teacher. And we'd come down, and she'd take us to the zoo or the domes and the Milwaukee Public Museum. And it was always, you know, it was always thrilling to come and visit with her. So I've known her my entire life. And now in her advanced age, she was in need of someone to come and be her caregiver. And so in addition to just the simple basic things like meal preparation and laundry, she needed someone to come alongside her because she had accumulated a pretty large sum of money that she was really struggling with. What do I do with this now? You know, what do I do with this money? And so I was there. I mean, I have a background in business. I have a master's from Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. And so In a very unique way, I was qualified to be her, not only her caregiver, but her companion. And so having this ability as a sounding board, she said, and she wanted to put her money in an area that would have an impact, but also would survive. You know, when she gave her money to Carthage, her biggest concern was, is Carthage going to survive? Because she had gotten her master's from Cardinal Stritch in Milwaukee. And when she found out that it had closed, she blanched when she heard that. She said, I hope that doesn't happen to Carthage. So she was very aware of the risk that her money may or may not survive or may not have a legacy that she was hoping for.
Right, right. So it sounds like your great aunt has taken the matter of philanthropy very, very seriously, and that she has not been in any way careless in the way she has distributed her money. I mean, she's been really, really thoughtful and really is thinking a lot about legacy.
That is true. That is very true. And when she set up these scholarships at Bradford, she engaged the help of the principal. She wanted to get the money into the hands. She said the straight A kids are always going to have money. She said, I'm interested in kids who are very qualified and who are very capable, but don't test well. They might not write the best essay, but the ones who are going to become the outstanding nurses and the outstanding firemen and the outstanding EMTs, I want to help those kids. So she has a heart for either underdogs or some of the overlooked people. So she has a beautiful heart and wanted to, you know, use her money to help people like that.
That's great. For those of you just joining us, we are talking today in this portion of the morning show about the Kenosha Community Foundation. We have with us Executive Director Amy Grile, and we also have with us John Keel, who is here because a new fund has been created that honors the legacy of Grace Kolakowski, and it is earmarked for the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. John Keel, do you remember a lot of discussion in terms of what performing arts or arts organization she wanted to turn her attention to, and what ultimately inspired her to make this choice of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra as the recipient of this new fund?
Well, she has a great love for classical music, as do I. And so I must admit that I had a very strong influence in her choice for the symphony. That was not 100% her. She wanted the Performing Arts Center to be for the community. However, so Siebel Chapel became that vehicle. And
yes.
So it's both a religious center and it's also a performing arts center. So that was great. But she said, I want something that's more mainstream performing arts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the obvious choice in the city is the symphony. It's the biggest organization. It's got an 85-year history.
Yes.
She wanted to be a part of that, and I wanted to be a part of that as well. And following her example of philanthropy, both in terms of money but also in terms of time, she inspired me to contact Pete Rodriguez, who's the president of the symphony.
Yes.
And so I'm now their newest board member.
Ah.
And so I wanted to get involved and use my business background, my love of the arts, to help that organization. And so Grace has kind of shown me, you know, you get involved any way that you can, whether it's with the money, your time, talent, or treasure, and help, you know, give back.
Hmm.
Give back to things that matter.
I love that. Pete Rodriguez has been on the morning show a number of times whenever we talk with Maestro Robert Hasty about the next Kenosha Symphony concert. Peter is typically on board as well, and of course not only as president of the board, but also as a proud member of the French horn section orchestra.
Right.
So I appreciate the way in which he brings a musician's appreciation to all of this. I mean, once in a while you have very hardworking, capable board members, but who they themselves, you know, maybe have scant understanding of what it means to be a musician or what kind of the musical aspects of it all are. And I appreciate how Pete Rodriguez is both.
And so the other part of the story I want to tell you is that I became a board member late last fall. And so just in those initial first meetings, you kind of get an idea of the financial status of the organization. And it was obvious to me that it needed a little bit more firmer foundation. And so that's when the idea for this designated fund with a Kenosha Community Foundation came about, is that how can we sustain this legacy? And so speaking with Amy, that's where the idea came from. I presented that idea to my great aunt, and she loved it, and funded the fund.
That's great. So Amy Grile, explain kind of the nuts and bolts, the logistics then of once there is this agreement that Grace Kolakowski wants to extend her legacy in this way, then what needed to happen in terms of the Kenosha
sure.
Community Foundation?
Sure. It's a pretty straightforward process. So once we can identify the charitable intent, we decide kind of what's that vehicle. As John mentioned, we do scholarship funds. But back to that conduit, we want to be really in the space of designated funds, because that means ultimately we empower the donor to say, this is the organization that I want to support, and I want to set up an endowment on their behalf for the long haul. We're not going to change the organization year to year. That would be a donor advised fund. The designated fund is really like this vehicle, this Cadillac vehicle, to where the foundation's the conduit, but you know, the donor decides, yep, I want to give it to the symphony orchestra for the long haul. We're going to sign an agreement, pretty straightforward, just to say what's the name of the fund, how does our board ultimately then take possession of that gift, and basically then you're transferring it permanently to the foundation's control, and then we steward that gift in perpetuity and give the annual grant as we decide at the outset. So that's a designated fund, where from the time the donor sits down, it's set. We don't change, I mean, only in the worst of cases that the symphony would ideally not have this happen, but if they were to close up shop, then we would have to, you know, find a similar purpose. Our board would reassign that gift, but ultimately it's a really nice and clean way where we're not going back and forth with the donor every year, as I say, and there's I mean, this is a really sustained commitment for a very, I think, mature philanthropist that really knows what they want to do.
Right, and who has a grandnephew that also knows how all of this works, which is helpful. So what will the Kenosha Symphony be able to do with this new stream of funding? Will they be free to spend it as they choose, or are there ways in which that is, in a sense, earmarked with this?
Sure,
fund?
Great question. We don't patrol or police the designated fund grant, so it's really, I mean, it's unrestricted. You know, we issue the grant, and they are empowered to use it as such. Of course, they're not accessing the full breadth of the gift. We retain the principal. They get access to the interest earned. And in this case, we could almost fund an entire concert, you know, just a whole concert, you know, on the way. I mean, as this fund grows, all the more. But I mean, to imagine they offer four concerts annually.
Three.
Oh, even three. Okay.
Three.
Well, and one of the three can be, you know, kind of cost covered by a single gift. That is where we want to be.
That's extraordinary.
Awesome.
Well, and it's so helpful for a group like this because so often grants to arts organizations are closely restricted and often do not grant funding for just normal operations. It has to be because you're going to buy something special. And this kind of thing is just so helpful to the fund.
And you can't depend on them because you have to reapply and you may or may not get them. Where this is the money that they can depend on year after year and build into their budget. And so to give that kind of stability and ability to project the future is very important to any nonprofit, you know,
fantastic.
To have that stability.
Amy Grile, you made passing reference to this fund potentially growing. Explain how that would happen for this amount of money, for this pot of money to actually grow. How is that likely to occur?
Sure. So we first wouldn't make a grant in the first year, so we have to allow the gift to earn interest in our investment pool. So we have a prudent approach, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Last year we earned 14.6% on our investments. So certainly we are going to issue 5% of the value of the asset, so to speak. So this gift to the symphony, we would take 5% next year. And I think it's at the end of this year in any fact, but we take 5%. So the remaining earnings, of course, stay with the fund. So
right.
The value is growing over time. But the, I mean, even cooler part of it is that now that Grace and John have like seeded the fund, it's open to the community to contribute towards. So we have it on our website. You can find it under the donate page. You can scroll down through the designated funds, and there it is.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
So let's say someone has $500 that they would like to contribute to the symphony. You had mentioned before that it was like a $10,000 minimum. Now that the fund has been established, do these smaller amounts, are they still
absolutely
able to be?
Absolutely. Yep. So we have a whole different, like, sort of schedule of, you know, how people can establish new funds and what the fees are per fund, et cetera. But yeah, once that is set up and named, we're good to go. I mean, any small gift, of course, is added to the endowment. That's not to say that $500 in is $500 out. You know, it's just added to the value of, yes, the principal. So, but yeah, you can use a credit card or, you know, send a check, however that looks. If you want to denote that this is for the Symphony Orchestra Fund, we will be glad to get you started on your path to philanthropy as well.
That's absolutely fantastic. And John Keel, I'm glad you asked for that clarification because, yeah, we did make that that statement was made about, you know, kind of the bottom figure for really
right.
setting an endowment in motion.
Right.
But that does not mean gifts of that magnitude must be made to be part of this.
Right.
I mean,
and I think it also speaks to Grace's being at the vanguard, and she wants to be she puts her money where her mouth is, and she's a leader. And she said, you know, come, this is important to me, come follow me. And so, you know, with the Performing Arts Center, she got that started. And now with the symphony, it's like, this is an important cultural institution in this city. anybody who shares this interest or this passion, please join me in this. It's not just all about her and her fund. It's like, I'm just getting this thing started. Come join me.
Come be part of this wonderful effort.
With me, yes.
That's so good. That's so good. So, Amy Grile, if people are interested in more information about anything that we've talked about today, but in particular this fund set up in honor of Grace Kolakowski, what should they do?
Well, certainly I'm a phone call away. We are a small shop, but, you know, our door is always open. And we love those conversations with people that are just starting to explore this. I mean, I'm new to the field of philanthropy as well. Come from the nonprofit sector, so I know fairly well what's out there. If they're not sure what, you know, how does this look and how would I even begin, you know, I can certainly seed them with some ideas from our grant that we give year round. So I know some of the good actors, if you will, you know, trying to just try, like, help them navigate like grant making, because even that is quite a science and a field. And how do you do it meaningfully? Because even John mentioned that when Grace arrives to the later part of her life and she says, you know, I have amassed a wealth here, but I don't know what to do with it. That's actually more common than you think, that people, you know, even farmers, and my dad would look at me and say, are you serious? You're going to give money away? You give money away. But for many people, they're surprised as they look back at their life and say, wow, I really do have disposable income here, and my kids are taken care of, or maybe I don't have kids, and why not keep it right here that supported your family, supported you? I mean, I'm just so passionate about the Kenosha community and communities generally, like, as those breeding grounds for, you know, successful lives and quality of life. And I don't want people buying homes down in Florida. I want people investing in endowments right here.
Right here in their community.
Absolutely.
Very well put. So we encourage people to reach out to the Kenosha Community Foundation to find out more about all of the good work that they do. Amy Grile is their executive director, and John Keel, speaking on behalf of his wonderful, extraordinary great aunt, Grace Kolakowski. So great to have both of you here today for the morning show. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. That's actually one of the few pieces of classical music that probably does not require introduction for most people. Even people with scant interest in classical music or knowledge about it probably have some notion of that being the opening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Of course, you cannot take that for granted when you are talking about young children. And of course, more and more the sad reality is that classical music is something that more and more youngsters are less and less likely to encounter, which makes it all the more important for those of us who care about classical music to take in hand an exciting new book called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. This is a book conceived of and written by Carolyn Sloan, who is a highly regarded musician and songwriter with a long resume involving television, theater, and outreach to children. And she is a music educator at the Berklee Carroll School in Brooklyn, New York. So she knows a lot about how to connect with young children when it comes to getting them excited about classical music and getting them to maybe broaden their horizons, let down their resistance, and be willing to encounter classical music and all that it has to offer. This is a beautifully written book. It, at a glance, looks like kind of a standard, colorful children's book, but it has some sound component to it that is really quite intriguing and helpful, beautifully illustrated by James Williamson. And I'm very happy to have the author, Carolyn Sloan, with me for the next few minutes to talk about Welcome to the Symphony. Carolyn Sloan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Before we get talking about your book, could you just say a word about the Berkeley Carroll School and the work that you do there?
Sure. The Berkeley Carroll School is a pre-K through 12 college preparatory school. It's an independent school in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I teach music there to grades 2 through 4, and I also oversee the lower school music program as well. I teach chorus as well. I think it's really important to, in addition to teaching skills, for kids to develop a vocabulary and a passion for all different kinds of music. And in the last couple of years in my work with kids there, I really started noticing that kids knew less and less about the orchestra and knew less and less about the instruments that even play in the orchestra. I had a third grader who said, well, what's a clarinet? And at which point I said, okay, we have to do something about this.
To what do you attribute that? Because there are a lot of things in the world around us, particularly in terms of technology, that would seem to suggest that anybody should be able to access just about anything. Is it that there is so much open to people now that that certain important things just kind of get lost in this blizzard of information? Or are there other things at work here that would explain why fewer and fewer youngsters seem to know anything at all about classical music?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and it's a big question, and probably has a couple of different answers. But I think in my experience is that children are kind of inundated right now with whatever is put in front of them. And by what I mean by that is, you know, whatever is the latest thing is sort of all over the place. It's on TV and it's advertised online, and kids are very, very interested in interactive things, and so computer games and anything that they're going to do in front of a screen is going to sort of take interest and take their focus. And I think parents right now have a really big responsibility in terms of making sure that their kids are being introduced to the things that they feel are important and that they want them to be introduced to. And if for whatever reason classical music is not on the agenda, then a lot of kids are not really being introduced to it. I noticed that even in my school that a lot of the kids had not been to a symphony, and so we started partnering with the New York Philharmonic in their education school day concerts. And I know that any city that has a symphony orchestra, I'm sure, has a really good education department, and it's a great thing to take advantage of, because a lot of the time those concerts are subsidized and it doesn't really cost a lot to take your kid to a concert. It's really important. But I think also the advance of technology has really kind of eclipsed classical music, which unfortunately is not a great thing.
Right. And of course, if you're seeing that in a place like New York City, we imagine that it might potentially be an even worse problem in some little town in Idaho or North Dakota, or some place where there is no symphony in town, and where something like a symphony orchestra is only something you might see a picture of, unless somebody makes a concerted effort to bring this across your path.
It's really true, which is why I was motivated to create Welcome to the Symphony, because I really wanted to reach all kids everywhere, and I thought that if you give them these excerpts of the symphony in sound and you make it immediately gratifying for them, meaning that they can push that button and they can hear the first 20 seconds, that excerpt that you played, and you can hear the last 20 seconds of the first movement, and you can hear all the important themes in the first movement of the Beethoven symphony, then maybe kids will go, oh yeah, well, I want to hear the rest of that, which is exactly what's beginning to happen. That's the feedback that I'm getting. The kids are like, oh, I want to hear that. And the whole idea is exposure often and early, early and often.
We're speaking with Carolyn Sloan, a music educator and composer and writer, about the children's book she has just created called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. I want to ask you why Beethoven and why Beethoven's Fifth, although, I mean, at a glance, that might seem like an absurd question. I mean, what better place to start with than Beethoven's Fifth just because it's already such a famous piece. And yet, just because it's famous to the rest of us doesn't necessarily mean that's a great piece with which to try to connect classical music to young people or to get them excited about it. But there's obviously some things about Beethoven's Fifth that you think make it an ideal choice for a book like this. What is it about Beethoven's Fifth that led you to choose it?
I think the very clear and very simple motifs that he introduces in the beginning, the whole rhythmic da-da-da-da, you know, that whole part of it is very easy for kids to grasp right away. And the themes are very distinct and repeat often. And I think that's a key, because when kids can kind of latch on to something they can identify and identify over and over again, the piece becomes familiar to them. And once it becomes familiar to them, then they really like it. And I think, first, I'm a big fan of Beethoven. And, you know, I played a lot of Beethoven as a kid, as a pianist. But I just love the idea of being able to sort of extract those themes and introduce them to kids and have them kind of immediately identifiable.
So when you decided then that it would be Beethoven's Fifth, take us through your thought process in terms of how you actually went about putting the book together and sort of the journey that you take the reader, in a sense, via three small visitors to the concert hall.
Yes. Well, originally, the idea was a pretty simple one. I said, okay, well, I want kids to experience what it might be to go to a symphony, since a lot of them haven't really been. What is it going to be like? From the minute that you walk into the hall, what do you see? What do you hear? And, you know, to make that experience really, really kind of a vital and an alive one for them, to the end of, like, well, do we clap at the end of the first movement? Oh, no, we don't. So we thought initially that we were going to use a family going to the symphony, and then we thought, no, you know what, let's use something like these three little mice who can be sitting in the rafters and experiencing it for the first time. And we found that actually sort of tested better with younger readers. So they walk into the concert halls and they sort of see everybody on stage and they hear them tuning. So that, you know, then there's the button that you can push to hear them tune. Then you see the conductor walk on stage and one of them asks, well, who's that guy? Is he late? You know, and then it's sort of explaining everything almost through the eyes and ears of a very young reader, a young child. And then I wanted to be able to sort of pick out those things that would make the piece really exciting for the readers to listen to. And the whole time I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, well, I don't just want it to be on the page, because quite honestly, as a musician and as a music educator, I had read so many music books to my kids and also to my own son as a parent that had no music, or that had a CD that you had to put into a drive, and now, you know, they don't even make those anymore in your computers. So I wanted it to be very, very accessible. So I said, I want them to hear everything. I want them to hear them tuning. I want them to hear just the violins, and I want them to understand what it means to hear that first 20 seconds, and they're so excited and they're listening, you know, what happens now. And so, I mean, I'm trying to answer your question in the most complete way I can, but I wanted them to sit and listen to it and experience it the way that they would if they were in a concert hall.
Explain, as you start talking about specific instruments of the orchestra, the added component of sound with this book that can serve as such a nice, tangible introduction for the young reader.
Well, I think so many kids don't know what these instruments are, and they haven't really heard them. And that goes back to these music books that are great, but they don't have that oral component where they can really demonstrate what the instrument sounds like. So what's great about it, I think, is you really start to make connections. Like my students at school would press the violin button, and by the time they got to the double bass, they kind of formed their own observations and conclusions about, oh, well, you know, the smaller instruments have the higher sound, and the larger instruments, they seem to have the lower sound. And then they understand the difference between the different sections in the orchestra. And so they understand that, oh, well, these instruments are responsible for these kinds of themes. But then, oh, we hear that theme again played in this different section with the woodwinds. And a lot of kids have never heard of an oboe or a bassoon. And they not have they not heard it or seen it, but they... I mean, they haven't been able to name it, but they don't know what it sounds like. So to make it really concrete for them is a wonderful thing, I think. Mm. And immediately, you know, that's the technological part of it. I was like, well, I don't want to do an ebook. I really love kids to have books in their hands. You know, the whole, well, we can talk about fine motor function after, but it's so great for them to be able to hold the book, but then also have the sound, as if they would if they were sitting next to their iPad or their computer.
Absolutely. I am a big fan as well of holding a physical book in one's hand, and it's nice that this book is that, and yet at the same time, at the touch of a button allows the young reader to experience some of these moments from the symphony or the sounds of these various instruments. You mention in the afterword of the book that you have a son named Sam.
Yes,
and that you went out of your way to make sure that Sam would be exposed to classical music and you hoped would come to really appreciate it. I'm just curious how old Sam is now and if those efforts to make this a part of his life ultimately sort of took root.
Well, they really did, actually, and I think it they took root so much it surprised me even. He's 19 now, and he's a sophomore at the Manhattan School of Music.
Ah.
And he plays double bass, and actually it's his double bass sound that you're hearing in the book, and a lot of the conservatory students in and around New York City. So we have some of the best young musicians playing the sound files in the book. I did go out of my way for him to learn about the orchestra and classical music because I thought, well, you know, pop music is so ubiquitous and he's going to hear it when he goes to school. I don't need to introduce him to that. You know, of course, my husband is a big fan of the Beatles and different music that we listened to when we were growing up, but we just thought, oh, you know, he'll be able to hear that other stuff. It's on the radio all the time. And little did we know that now he's such a classical music lover, he really listens to classical music more than anything else. But we would play it in the car. I'd play it while, you know, he was taking a bath, or, you know, we would play games to it. We were always playing classical music, and I teach classical piano as well, so he heard a lot of it in the house.
Well, it always makes life better when it's when that kind of music is part of it, and so we encourage people who with young children to think about sharing with them this beautiful book called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, published by Workman Publishing, and the author, Carolyn Sloan. Carolyn Sloan, it was great to talk with you, and thank you for creating this lovely book, which we hope will open up the world of classical music to a whole host of young readers.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of Kaylin Palomares. And she is going to be joined by Kenosha County Executive Samantha Kirkman and County Board Vice Chair Daniel Gushke to talk about the latest in the Pike River Restoration Project. On Friday, we'll be hearing from the Racine County Violent Crime Reduction Coordinator, Nikita Hamer, and also from Jim Schatzman about the next concert of the Choral Arts Society. We are working to rectify a technical issue with our morning show archive. In the meantime, you can listen to past interviews on the podcast version of the morning show. Look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be cloudy with rain developing later this morning, snow showers over the afternoon, possibly an inch of accumulation. High today of 43 degrees, overnight low of 35, with a good chance of more precipitation tonight. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.